Did you ever stop to think that we described emotions as feelings, as in something you can actually feel by touch? Or think about other phrases in common use, like, I just can't put my finger on it. Today's guest says we should not be surprised because the sense of touch is of critical importance to who we are and what we do as human beings. David J. Linden wrote a book about the subject called Touch: The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. David J. Linden is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University Medical School. He is a former chief editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology, and he's been a guest on The Exchange before, talking about his previous book, The Compass of Pleasure. David, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me back.
We can only guess your examination of pleasure might have led you to examining touch more specifically.
Well, that's absolutely right. When I think of what to write about in terms of brain function for a general audience, I think about my own life, and I think about what is most compelling and motivating, and touch is certainly rises to the top of the list.
I love the story of you and fellow teenagers many years ago sitting around a campfire ring talking about the sense you would keep if you had to lose the rest of them.
Yes, this is a true story from my misspent youth, and what always struck me in this would you rather game, would you rather lose all your senses except sight or except hearing, is that no one ever chose to retain touch, and yet we were all obsessed with touch. We were all, obsessed with girlfriends and boyfriends and sex and caressing and all those things, and yet we never chose touch as the sense to preserve in this game. And I think the reason is that it kind of fades into the background to a certain extent. You can close your eyes and imagine being blind, and you can plug your ears or plug your nose, but you can't ever turn off your touch sense, which is always on. And I think as a consequence, we tend to discount it a bit.
I'm thinking of us as babies in the way we're reaching for everything. We want to touch everything. Of course, a lot of it goes to our mouths right after that, too. But the fact is that the longing for that desire to touch things never really goes away, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And in the case of babies putting things in their mouths, I think it's worthwhile noting that the lips and tongue are very, very well endowed with the kind of touch receptor that's also located in places like your fingertips that can discern very fine spatial detail. You can, if necessary, read Braille with your lips and tongue, for example.
Well, you went there. Why don't we talk about the other parts of the body that have been tested with Braille?
Oh, okay. Well, clearly I know where you're heading. So we think, what are the sensitive parts of our skin? Well, certainly our fingertips are very sensitive, and our lips and tongue are very sensitive. Now, a place like the cornea of the eye is very sensitive. If you get a tiny piece of grit in your eye, it doesn't take a very much deflection of your cornea to hurt, but you can't localize it very well. And the same thing is true with another area that's sensitive but not discriminative, and that is the genitals. So if you try to read Braille with your genitals, you'll fail because the genitals lack the kind of nerve ending named after an anatomist called Merkel, so they're Merkel endings, that you need to discern fine spatial form. And if your listeners don't believe me, they can wait till no one's around and go down to the ATM and give it a try.
Yikes. I figured we needed to bring that up. It does come up in the book. It is boggling, though, mind-boggling, the range of things that we use touch for. And you open our eyes, in a sense, to all of this with the fact that it's everything from consumer choice to sexual intercourse.
Well, it is. And I think, when considering this, it's worthwhile to think about what exactly touch sense is, because to us it's a fused sensation, but when you look at the skin, what you find are actually many, many different kinds of nerve endings, each specialized to convey a different kind of sensation. So there's one for pain. Actually, there are two for pain. There's at least one for itch. There's one for hot and for cold. There are mechanical sensors, one for vibration, one for texture, one for skin stretching, one for microscopic slips between your skin and objects. So all these different sensors, their information passes to the brain in rather parallel lines, But then it's blended in the brain to give you a unified touch sensation.
Okay, so a bunch of different sensations coming in, but the brain figures out what is what.
Well, the brain, it's not so much that it figures out what is what, is that it blends it all together to create a perception for us. In other words, when we touch something, we don't have to think, oh, that's a little bit of heat and a little bit of pressure and some vibration, and so together it's blah, blah, blah. We just go, oh, that's a warm, oily thing.
We talked at the very beginning here, before we even got you on, about how we describe emotions as feelings, a point you bring up in the book. But you also point out that we use the term tact to describe people who, actually have a fairly light touch, I guess. And it comes from tactile. So it's here again, so much of our emotional language actually comes from our touch language.
Well, it does. So touch and emotion have been fused in English. We know at least from texts, from the going back to the 13th century. So you might think, oh, you know, the phrase "I'm touched" to mean I'm emotionally affected, or "my feelings" to mean my tender emotions, or "someone is tactless" to mean they're emotionally clumsy. Literally, they lack touch. That these are just expressions in contemporary English, but they're not just contemporary, and they're not just in English. They're actually found not in every language, but in nearly every language.
Well, the universality of touch. The book is called Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. David J. Linden is the author and our guest on The Exchange. Back with David and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the sense of touch today, as brought up in the book Touch by David J. Linden, subtitled The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. David is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University Medical School. He joined us earlier to talk about his book The Compass of Pleasure a few years ago, and it sort of extends into a more localized look at how we deal with touch and how important it is to us as human beings. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments at 800-838-3760 around the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. David, I have to point out you're the second person recently to bring up John B. Watson counseling parents in the 20s not to touch their kids too much. That's a really interesting thing, and obviously one we don't hold to anymore.
Yes, so back in that time, Watson said, well, you know, you shouldn't hug your kids or kiss them. Give them a pat on the head if they've been unusually good. Shake their hands in the morning and basically treat them like little tiny adults. And yeah, this is terrible advice. And we now know that appropriate interpersonal touching, particularly of kids by their parents, is really crucial for developing bonds of trust and cooperation throughout life. And in particular, in very early life, it's actually not optional. And, you know, in a way, it's counterintuitive, because someone's born blind, then grow up just fine. Their body's fine, their mind is fine. Same if you're born deaf. But if you're an infant or a toddler and you're not touched the way orphans in the Romanian orphanages in the 1980s and 90s were, then a whole disaster unfolds. Kids develop chronic self-soothing obsessive behaviors. They have attachment disorders, slowed cognitive development. And it's not just limited to neuropsychiatric issues. Actually, there become problems with the development of the digestive system and the immune system. And the really bad news is, if these kids don't get touch within the first 2 years of life, social touch, loving touch, then these problems persist throughout their entire lives, and they have very high incidence of depression, bipolar disorder, obesity, immune problems. The list goes on and on. Touch is not optional for early human development.
I'm really struck by the physical manifestations you talk about, where the body just doesn't even quite finish forming, it sounds like, if the kids aren't touched and nurtured in that way.
Yeah, it's amazing. And in truth, we don't understand the biology of that. So in other words, we don't have a molecular and cellular explanation that says when you're touched early in life, it sets in motion this cascade of signals that contributes to proper development in this way. Those details remain a mystery, largely.
Now, there's a bunch in here about psychologist Solomon Ash and his work. What did he find about things like our responses to warm and cold?
Well, what Solomon Ash found, Solomon Ash was a social psychologist who was active really starting in the 1930s and continuing for many years. And he was very interested in how we rapidly form impressions of people and what are the dimensions that we evaluate. Because, you know, you meet someone new and you form an impression of them very, very rapidly. I mean, it can be modified. It may not be there for forever. But really the first dimension on which we evaluate people is, are they warm or are they cold? Meaning, are they trustworthy or are they a threat? Might they do me harm? And then the second dimension we evaluate people on is, are they competent? Because if someone's a threat but they're not competent to harm you, then you don't have to worry about them. What I think is really interesting is how this followed up many, many years later. There's experiments done at Yale by a guy named John Barg and his group. And they found that if people were holding a hot drink immediately before reading a resume, they would rate the person that they were reading about on the resume as literally warmer, that is to say, more friendly, more cooperative, more trustworthy. Whereas if they were holding a cold drink, they would rate them lower on that scale. And I think the important thing is that the hot drink didn't make them rate that person better in every way. Like, they didn't say they were smarter or more serious about the job or more driven. Literally, they were warmer.
Wow. So that there are some cautionary notes, I guess, for us to make sure that when we're meeting new people or something, we either have our hands empty or at least something comfortable to us.
Well, you know, it depends how you want to appear, right? Do you want to appear warm? If you're negotiating a business deal, maybe you don't want to appear warm. Maybe you want to appear to be a threat. So in that context, it might be to your advantage to have a cold drink. But if you want to make a good impression in a social situation, yeah, the warm drink would serve you better. There's another great example. People were given resumes to evaluate on either a very light, flimsy clipboard or an extremely heavy clipboard that weighed several pounds, like about the weight of an old-school laptop. And what they found is that when people were asked to evaluate the very same resumes, they said that the people who they read on the heavy clipboard were literally had more gravitas. They were more serious. They were more motivated. Again, they weren't rated as smarter, and they certainly weren't rated as warmer. But this rather incidental touch sensation helped form the initial impression of these individuals.
And do we have any idea why the body is wired this way? I mean, what was the benefit in prehistoric days when we were still in trees or something to get these senses like this?
Well, that's a great question. The answer is we don't know. In other words, you kind of think it seems like this is a little bit of a bug, right? There's no good reason why the coffee cup you're holding should change your evaluation of someone. I think it is a byproduct of other things. I mean, the thing to keep in mind when you go look for evolutionary explanations is that there isn't always one. Sometimes what happens is merely the side effect of something else.
All right, so just in general terms with touch, I mean, obviously we've come a long way since John B. Watson told us not to touch our kids, and I can just imagine the generation of children that got produced by that book. But we seem to want to touch each other a lot, more than we used to. I mean, men hug in ways that they didn't used to, for example, in our society. But I'm curious, too, about things like, and I think you make some reference to this in the book as well, like when you see basketball teams playing, and even when a guy misses a foul shot, guy or woman, doesn't matter, they always have to slap hands with all the teammates.
Well, right, and so there's very ritualized social touching in lots of sports, and basketball is a great example, and there was a study done by Dr. Keltner and his colleagues at the Greater Good Science Project at UC Berkeley. And what they did is they took a whole season of NBA games, and they watched the videos, and they got a whole crew of helpers to do this, obviously, because there's a lot of tape, and they scored all the social touch that occurred on the basketball court, all the high fives and chest bumps and butt pats and all the things that players do particularly when they celebrate something, or as you say, even if a free throw is missed. And what they found is that the teams that had more interpersonal touch both won more games, and then they played more cooperatively. So, for example, players were more likely to pass off to their teammate who was open for a better shot than they were, rather than taking the shot themselves. They were more willing to sacrifice their own personal glory for the good of the team. It instilled cooperation. And this is not unique to sports or unique to the NBA. Appropriate interpersonal touch builds trust and cooperation in all kinds of situations. Now, I think the important thing to mention, though, is that, of course, there are a lot of different social and religious rules for this. So in different communities and different cultures, it doesn't always work exactly the same way, because there are a lot of prohibitions against certain kinds of social touching, particularly between the sexes.
Well, and then that's why I'm glad you used the word appropriate, because I can just see people going, "Oh, okay, I guess I can motivate my employees by giving them a little touch on the shoulder and stuff." And next thing you know, somebody's complaining to HR about what's happened there.
Well, that's absolutely right. It's all dependent on social context. And I think the really, really fascinating thing is that it actually feels different. So imagine, if you will, you know, an arm around your shoulder from your sweetheart in a connected, loving time. And then imagine that very same arm around your shoulder with the exact same pressure, touching the exact same place on your body exactly the same way, but in the middle of an argument that hasn't been resolved. It's not just that it feels the same, but you think about it differently. It actually feels different. It feels unwelcome at the very moment you perceive it. Imagine that arm around your shoulder from a domineering boss, or your best friend, or someone hitting on you in a bar. You know, each one of these touches feels differently, even though the pattern of activation of the touch sensors in your skin and your muscles is identical. And this tells us an important lesson, which is that the perception of touch, and in truth the perception through all the other senses as well, is deeply modulated by context. And the way this happens is that the higher areas of the brain that are involved in computing social context send information to the primary somatosensory cortex, which is the place where touch is initially felt, and modifies its activity to make these different touches feel different.
David J. Linden is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University Medical School and the author of Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. You can join the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Linden.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I want to first make an observation and then ask a question. In terms of young people, or most people today, they're all kind of in love with their smart device, you know, their cell phone. And there's industrial psychologists who actually design those things that certain things, like the size of a packet of cigarettes that fits into your hand, is something that you want to hold and that you want to palm and that you want to touch. And Steve Jobs knew this when he was designing the iPod, and that carried over to the iPhone. Of course, if you have something that's really big and kind of bulky, you don't want to carry it in your hand. But part of the reason why people touch their smartphones, and it's the last thing they touch when they go to bed at night, the first thing that they reach for when they wake up in the morning, is the industrial psychology and the touch and the sensation with the hand. Now, I have a separate question regarding the sense of sound and how it is not additive. For instance, if I like, for instance, pictures of sunny days, and I like the Grand Canyon, and I like supermodels and bikinis, and I have a picture that has all of those in it, it kind of summates. You know, it makes me want to like that picture more. Uh-huh. Or if I like neck massages and hand massages and back rubs, and I get them all at once, it's all additive. However, if I like a particular music piece, let's say Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and I play one in one ear, and then I play my second favorite song, you know, let's say a Mahler Symphony, in my other ear, it's not additive. It's actually disharmonious, and it's very torturous to listen to. So I want to ask that concept about additive sensation in the sense of sound.
Okay.
You know, why isn't it, or even if I just took Beethoven's Ninth and played the same piece, but was just staggered by a half a second.
All right, discordance for sure. That might be outside the scope of what we're talking about here, but David, what do you think?
Well, so first I actually want to comment on what you mentioned about industrial design. And this is something that was actually known in a handbook for marketers in the 1930s that exhorted designers to make things that the phrase they used was snuggle in the palm, you know, whether it's a perfume bottle or a pack of cigarettes or now a smartphone. And it turns out that actually when marketers do surveys now and they ask people about their buying decision about their smartphones, you would think it would all be about the tech specs, you know, what's the resolution of the screen, what software does it run, etc. But actually about a third of the people say the biggest factor in my decision was how it felt in my hand. Now, to get to this issue about sound versus sight, the issue has to do with simultaneity. When you have a visual scene, you don't really take it in all at once. Your eyes move in both smooth motions and rapid jerks all over the scene to take over the different elements. So if we had a video camera pointed at your eyeball while you looked at your picture with all these different elements in it you'd like, we would find that you were pointed at one time and one at another time and one at another time, but you can't actually be pointed all of them at the same time. And as a consequence, you can regulate where your attention is to the different aspects. Whereas if you have two different musics or sounds that are offset, as you mentioned, playing in two different ears, there's no easy way to selectively attend to one or the other, and as a consequence, they interfere with that, and it becomes hard to attend, and it becomes frustrating. So that's the reason.
But you also get into situations, I understand, where when the senses are working together, you'll get different readings, and it's, I think, probably similar to what you were talking about, where the kind of touch that might be nice in a "gee, I love you" caress is not welcome in the middle of an argument. But if you hear a scratchy noise when you're touching something soft, it makes you think that what you're touching is actually rough. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's right. So there's a great example of this that's called the parchment hands illusion. And what you do is you have someone rubbing their hands together, and you have a microphone that picks up the sound, you know, the very subtle sound of hands rubbing together, and amplifies it a little bit and then puts it into headphones. And these are the kind of headphones that seal all the way over the ears, so you don't hear the outside world at all. And so you have people rate the dryness of their hands and in the control condition, and then you put an electronic device in the middle so that you're filtering the sound so that you're emphasizing the high frequency aspects of that sound. And when you do that, people rate their hand as being drier. So what this points out is a very general idea. That is, most of the time when we are in the world, we are blending multiple senses together, and our perception is a gestalt, and the senses can influence each other. And not only that, but there are what theorists call Bayesian priors. That is, we have expectations about the world that guide the way we interpret our sensory information. We expect gravity to operate. We expect the sun to be up in the sky and not down by our feet, for example. And some of these things are baked into our nervous system evolutionarily, and some of them we develop through our experience of the world, through our individual lives.
But there's a good thing to develop that along the way, because that way you're not having to learn the world anew every day, right?
Absolutely, yes. We have a lot of assumptions. But what's interesting is that when those assumptions are violated, when expectations are violated, then it's very dramatic. Now, so let me give an example. This is my favorite cartoon drawn by a woman named Julia Wirtz. There's a man driving the car. There's a woman sitting in the passenger seat, and she's got a grocery bag on her lap. And the man says, "Oh, my God, something smells awful in here, like somebody farted. What is that?" And the woman looks in the grocery bag and says, that is the expensive French cheese we just bought. And the man replies, well, in that case, something smells absolutely delicious in here. And, you know, it's funny, but it points out something crucial about perception. And that is, the very same smell that's repulsive in a public toilet can be delightful in a cheese shop.
All right, much more to talk about with David Linden. His book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. We have a couple of phone calls waiting. We'll get to those in a few moments. You can join in as well, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back with David Linden and Touch and You in a minute 20. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the neuroscience professor David J. Linden, the previous author of The Compass of Pleasure. We talked to him about that a few years ago. He's back with a new book about the sense of touch called simply Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this highly critical sense of ours, 800-838-3760 across the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. You do get into primates in the book, David, and other mammals, and grooming and the things that go on there. Is it universal, though, across the animal kingdom?
No, it isn't. Not all animals groom each other. Animals groom each other when they live in social groups, and where the grooming serves a bonding function. But, for example, orangutans are fairly solo animals. You know, they meet to mate, and the male just kind of goes off by himself in the forest. So they have relatively little grooming because they have really relatively little social behavior. Now the mother will groom the infants, but adults don't groom each other very much.
We have a question here or a call from Sig in Gold Hill. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Linden.
Yes, I was going to ask Professor Linden if he was aware or remembered a study, I think it happened in Purdue University many, many years ago. Very quickly, they had people who were working in the library, in the school library. As they were checking people out, they were instructed not to make eye contact, not to make any conversation other than what they needed for the transactions, and to be very mechanical in doing that. And then they interviewed the people leaving and asked them what the transaction felt like to them, and the people pretty accurately described it for what it was, just very mechanical. Then they had the people change one thing. The next time the people came through, they were supposed to do exactly the same thing, be very mechanical and very abrupt, but just make sure when they hand the card back to the person, make sure they touch their hand. And then they interviewed the people coming out, and as the people were leaving, about 60% of them said that the person had been cheerful, had been friendly, had made eye contact, had done all these things, none of which actually took place. And they surmised that it was that one little thing that made the difference.
I've heard of similar studies, and some are cited in the book as well. Sig, thanks for the call. So, David Linden, how important is that single touch?
Well, that's a great... The listener brought up a really great example, and it is part of a large literature showing that, for example, doctors, when they engage in social touch, not just the mere touch of a physical examination, but, you know, a comforting hand on the shoulder or something like that, when they do that, their patients have lower stress hormone levels, have better medical outcomes, and rate the doctor as more caring. So a little bit of touch can go a long way. In restaurants, servers who gently touch their patrons get better tips. However, at least in the United States, this works better if the server is female. And it doesn't matter if the patron is female or male or gay or straight or bi. But female servers, I think, are seen as less of a threat in touching. Some people don't respond well to being touched by a male server, but almost everyone responds well to being touched by a female server.
Interesting. So there's a greater sense of creepy or at least wariness of a touch from a male.
There is, that's a culturally constructed thing, but it's very real.
Well, let's talk about what might not be culturally constructive when we get into gender differences, which is there a difference in the sense of touch between men and women? Is one more sensitive than the other, one more discerning than the other?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so if you take 1,000 women and you bring them into the lab and you have them touch with their index fingertip very fine gratings in order to determine their fine touch acuity, and then you do the same thing with 1,000 men, what you will find is that on average the women have finer discriminative ability in their fine touch than the men do. And so you would think, huh, well, why is that? Maybe the women have softer skin and it compresses more easily, and that helps. That turns out not to be the case. And then Dan Goldreich, a scientist at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada, noticed something interesting in the data. And he noticed that women with unusually large fingers performed like men, and men with unusually small fingers performed like the average woman. And here's the explanation. It turns out that you have a fixed number of fine touch receptors on your finger pad, and if you got a big fingertip, then the gaps between them are larger, and as a consequence, your fine touch perception is degraded a little bit. Whereas if you have a tiny fingertip, the gaps between them are smaller, and you have better fine touch. And so the ultimate determinant is fingertip size, which is something that on the average correlates with male versus female, but is not actually directly related to male versus female at all.
Well, you know, they have some skin cross sections in the book, and I remember these from school with, you know, the hairs and the sweat glands and all that stuff. I remember that part. I don't remember the touch nerves. How complicated are these mechanisms?
Oh my gosh, these nerves go everywhere. If you were able to see a model with the nerves that convey touch sensations streaming from your skin and your viscera to the brain, it would look like a road map of a big city. So they're very very complex. I think the important thing is that not every bit of skin is the same. So we mentioned, for example, that you can't read Braille with your genitals or your eyeball, that it lacks a particular receptor. But even the density of receptors changes in other areas. So the small of your back, for example, is rather poorly endowed with mechanical sensing touch fibers, whereas your fingertips and your lips are very good.
All right. There's something in there called the Meissner's corpuscle. What does that do?
So the Meissner's is an ending, and all these things, Merkel and Meissner, they're all named after the anatomists who first described them. Meissner's are really interesting there. It's there to detect microscopic slips. So, for example, you don't think when you pick up your recyclable paper cup full of coffee, you don't think about gripping it. But it's actually an important problem, because if you don't grip it strongly enough, it'll slide out of your fingers and fall. And if you grip it too tightly, you'll crush it. And you don't have to think about this. It's an automatic reflex. But the way that works is you grip it, and then as you pull it up, the tiny microscopic slips between the cup and your fingers and palms are being sensed. And if there are those little slips, then you have a reflex that applies just a little more force so that you can use the minimum force necessary to keep it from slipping out of your hand to pick it up. And, you know, this is very important. You don't want to crush the cup. You don't want to crush the child's hand you're holding. You don't want to crush the egg that you're picking up. And this is what the Meissner's do.
So I'm curious about the signals then. I mean, while you're trying to figure out, oh, geez, this is slipping from my grip, I better grip it tighter. Is it going back and forth to the brain, or is it just your hand reacting to it locally?
That's mostly going back and forth to the spinal cord.
Hmm.
So these reflexes have to be so fast that there really isn't time to get up to the brain, think about it, and then send a message down. This is a purely subconscious reflex. You know, as you know, you don't think actively about how you're gripping your cup unless something unexpected happens in that situation.
David, this has been a big obstacle, as I understand it, in robotics and prosthetics, trying to come up with artificial limbs that will do the kinds of things you're talking about here, where you won't crush the cup or let it drop out of your hands, but have that sensitivity of touch to find just the right pressure.
Right. So we've got four mechanical sensors in our hands, one for fine form, the Merkel, one for this microslip, the Meissner, one for skin stretching, called the Ruffini, and one for high-frequency vibration, called the Pacinian. And the Pacinian is really important because that's what allows you to detect things at the end of tools. So imagine you're in your garden and you've got a shovel in your hand and you are jamming the shovel into a pile of very, very soft sand, or you're jamming it into a pile of gritty cement or of soil with stones embedded into it, you can tell the difference in those because of sensations that are being transmitted through the tool all the way to your fingers and palms and activating Pacinian corpuscles in those places. Likewise, when you're driving a car, we don't think of a car as a tool, but it really is, you have a sense of whether the road is slippery or not, or gritty, or and that sense, that road feel that automotive enthusiasts rave about, is sensation that's being transmitted from the tires and the wheels up through the steering mechanism and the steering column to the steering wheel to the Pacinian corpuscles in your fingers and palms.
Ah, so those people who say the car and me were one unit, they're not kidding around.
No, they're not. I mean, what's interesting is that when we're in a car, our sense of our body space sort of expands to enclose the car. And this is why sometimes it's dangerous if you are used to driving a small car. Like, let's say you drive a Mini Cooper, and then you go somewhere and you rent a Hummer. Well, you know, it's really dangerous because you are sort of expecting that car to be like your Mini Cooper, and you have to actively think and attend to the fact that the Hummer is now much, much bigger. What's interesting is, like, if you wear, say, a tall hat, like a cowboy hat or a stovepipe hat, when you walk through the doorway, you will automatically duck, as you would to avoid bumping your head, to avoid bumping your hat, because that hat has become incorporated into your body schema.
Wow, that's pretty marvelous. Let's take a call from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Linden, the author of Touch.
Hi, thank you very much for the discussion. It sounds like a fascinating book. I'd like to ask about the prevalence of touch being associated with assault over the last 20 to 30 years. And I want to preface this by saying I'm in no way denigrating any of the reality and the research into sexual and physical assaults and et cetera. But it seems that there are situations where people are using the concept that you can be assaulted by someone else's touch as a means of control or as a way of expressing anger. That is, say you tap someone on the shoulder to ask them to be quiet in a theater, and they go up to the usher and say you assaulted them. Or in a context of a family, men being afraid to touch female children because there might be accusations. And I'm a woman, but I've talked to some of my male friends, and they've said that they have retreated over the last 10, 20 years from touching people because of this aura that you could be charged with some kind of assault, either physical assault or sexual assault or innuendo. And I wondered if that has become sort of a tool against touching and has somewhat repressed our willingness to touch other individuals.
Well, there is some stuff in the book about that. Thanks for calling, Connie. Appreciate that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and I think it calls for a big societal conversation because, obviously, as you said, we don't want to give any kind of green light to sexual predators, for example. However, when you make rules like the teacher can never touch the kids or the coach can never touch the kids, the sexual predators ignore the rule anyway, and the effect of these rules really winds up being that the kind of appropriate social touching that creates bonds of trust and cooperation doesn't form. You have these situations where there's like a second grade teacher, and the kid runs up to hug them, and they can't hug back, and they have to kind of peel the arms off and say, I'm sorry, and you see the kid's face just fall, and you think, you know, this is not a situation where this child's interests are actually being served by this well-meaning rule.
Let's take another call from James in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Linden. James,
Hello?
You're up. That's
Hello?
You. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, this is James in Grants Pass. I was wondering if there's a difference in touch between the age of the person. Like when your guest mentioned that size of the hand makes a difference in touch. What about babies, children, older people? Has there been any study concerning that?
All right, so when does it peak, for example, in life, and does it get duller with age? David?
Right, that's a great question. So let me talk about the kids first. And this is, Jeff, you really think like a scientist, because the very next paper by the scientist in Canada was addressing precisely that. He said, well, kids have little tiny fingers, so maybe they have fine touch on their fingertips. It's even better. And the answer is actually that they don't. There's a separate issue having to do with the maturation of the touch receptors that counterbalances the density of them in the case of little kids. However, we know a lot about what happens as you grow older, and unfortunately the news is bad. So starting at about age 20, every year you lose about 1% of your touch sensors in your skin. Actually, there are just fewer and fewer nerve endings. And you lose all the different kinds. So you lose heat and cold and pain and light touch and sexual sensation and everything. And you don't tend to notice it when you're young. You don't tend to notice it when you're middle-aged. But by the time you're elderly, it becomes a big problem. This is why, you know, old folks don't report pain from bed sores, for example, that you would think it would be devastating. Their pain receptors have been so downregulated by age.
Wow, it's a fascinating book, Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. David Linden's been our guest once again. David, thanks so much a second time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
All right, take care.